This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Duncan Merles made a living not fitting in. He went to an Ivy League college on an ROTC scholarship. His military supervisor asked him to refrain from wearing his uniform to the divestment protests. He won a medal for raids with Navy SEALs while he was in the Marines, but pretty much knows that he wasn't voting for the same political candidates as most of his buddies in the military. After his service, he went to journalism school, where he was the only military veteran. And when he took his first job in Mobile, Alabama, his northern sensibility helped him develop a reporter's detachment. But his affection for New Orleans and the Gulf Coast proved so strong that he gave himself over to that region and fell in love. He moved to Durham to write for the Herald Sun and eventually edit books for Algonquin, but he couldn't tear his heart from the Big Easy. He went back to write about a termite infestation for Harper's Magazine. That story was on the newsstands when Katrina struck. He wrote a cover story about New Orleans a year or so later that brought him national acclaim as a long-form documentary journalist. He now teaches at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke and also directs the literary program. And Duncan Merle joins me in the studio today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank.
Let's go back to New Orleans. What was your original introduction to that city?
Well, I was working as a reporter at the Mobile Press Register. And, you know, that whole region is one cultural region, the Gulf Coast, from Mobile to New Orleans on to Baton Rouge. And so New Orleans was the big city. Mobile, little city. New Orleans was a big city. And so we'd go over there quite often. I had occasion on a couple of stories that I worked on. You know, we had fugitives who were lammed up in New Orleans, and I would talk to people there or go over there and report things. I covered violence in St. Bernard Parish over fishing, and I just found that place so unusual for America. And I am just naturally attracted to the demimonde somehow, the underworld, and not to tar New Orleans entirely with that word, but there's a certain element of that. And I was just, have always been very emotionally, instinctively drawn to that place.
And you left Mobile, right? You were there and you were reporting on it. You mm-hmm. said you were drawn to it, but then you left there to go to D.C.
Yes. That was a weird decision on my part. I think that I had still internalized the journalism school hierarchy of things that you do in journalism, and one of those would have been, you know, the apex of your career would be covering DC, covering Congress. I had a very romantic notion of what it would mean to show up in the Capitol with my reporter's notebook, and I'd also grown up outside DC in Rockville, Maryland. Sometimes I think that I wish I'd stayed in Mobile. I loved it. I loved Bayou La Batrie. I loved Dauphin Island. I loved Mobile. I loved its history. I love that paper. The paper was in an old auto dealership, a very old building, and you could feel the presses running because the presses were in the building also. But I went up to D.C., and I was disabused fairly quickly of that romantic idea of what covering Congress is, and I'm sure you know what that's like.
Well, I mean, if you love the seamy underworld, there is no place better than D.C., but the crawfish ain't as good. So I know what you mean, and I guess you learned something about this affection you had that might have been, and maybe I'll ask you to talk about that, because how is it different? You clearly saw the Gulf as a region. Mm-hmm. It was something you loved, but apparently something as a kind of colorful artifact of American culture. Hey, mm-hmm. look at this place. Now you're in D.C. and you think to yourself, no, wait a minute. This is the kind of thing I want to do. That was the kind of thing I wanted to do.
Right, right. No, it is. It was. There's something about finding yourself in a place that is not entirely familiar that sort of amps up your attention, for me, an artistic, a literary interest in a place. You know, I just get very interested in everything, you know, because everything is new. You know, I was interested in Mobile about you know, the fact that they had a really old Mardi Gras celebration, which is a, you know, in on one way of looking at it, it's a very pale event compared to the one in New Orleans. But on the other hand, it was older and it was small and it was very community oriented. I was also interested in the ways that the things that you learn sort of intellectually, you know, some of the policies that are being that you read about or you're writing about if you're covering Congress actually play out. And so in Mobile at that time, that was a city that was hollowing out. You know, people were moving out and it was not what it had been at one time. To some extent, that was attractive to me because it was interesting for me to pay attention to what was moving in. But I had the idea that there was a certain rote quality to the reporting in on Congress and in D.C. that I didn't really want to be a part of anymore. And it was my own fault. I mean, it's not – I know plenty of reporters who find D.C. just as fascinating in a foreign kind of way that I didn't. I just – because my parents had been – my father had been involved in the federal government. Growing up around D.C., politics is in the water. To me, it didn't seem that foreign. It just seemed sort of boring.
Yeah, well, I think the key word is attention. And I think you've used it about three times already, that when you're in D.C. and you're covering politics, you are forced to pay attention to what is in the headlines, period. Mm-hmm. And I liken it a little bit to a little to taking a little kid on a walk. You know, yeah. You're trying to get to the end of the trail, and they stop every 4 feet because the stick is really fascinating. If you bothered to pay attention to the stick, you'd know they were right.
There was an easy way of reporting on Congress. I mean, you'd be a member of the press gallery, which is a wonderful thing because you can just step out and look out on the floor of the House or the Senate, right? But you'd get all of these. There would be – it was like a Christmas tree of flyers from all of the congressmen and senators, you know, their latest opinions about whatever it is that's happening. And you could start to see how over the course of a day, how everyone would be heading for the same story, right? And then what would happen would be there would be a vote called, especially the Senate. Vote called, so the senators were going to have to show up. So everyone piles out of the press gallery down, I think it was two stories, outside the elevators where you're cordoned off. And you're when the senators come up, the elevators to go out on the floor and vote, that's when you shout the same questions at them. Yeah. And then you run back and everyone writes the same story.
Same story. Yeah. 350 microphones, 1,000 cameras, one story.
That's right.
It is pretty incredible. Anyway, you came to Durham. Then.
Mm-hmm.
And now what was behind that decision?
Several things. One was that, you know, the papers down here had a real good reputation among journalism students. And at my school, you know, the News and Observer and the Herald Sun were seen as really good places to go work. So I'd kept that in the back of my mind. My father had also been a grad student at Chapel Hill, and I had heard quite a few really positive stories about Chapel Hill. My father had come from a small rural town in Northern California, and to him, Chapel Hill was just this explosion of possibilities and new things he hadn't known about in politics and art and music. And he also made me – well, he didn't make me. He gave me, you know, UNC Tar Heel football jerseys to wear when I was going to school. And so I had this idea that Chapel Hill was this great paradise.
And you wrote a story. You wrote for the Durham Herald Sun. And you wrote one story that won a prize. Tell us about that story.
So I'm sitting in the bureau that the Herald Sun had in Hillsborough, mostly covering Orange County government. And one day I'm sitting in there and this fellow comes in and he's decked out in camouflage, full camouflage. And he's kind of frantic and he's saying, "You got to come out here and see my truck." And I didn't have anything actually on the budget, as we say in the journalism trade, that day. So I went out into the parking lot. And there in the back of the truck, and I hope your readers will forgive me for this, but there was this gigantic dead deer in the back of the truck. It was a 13-point buck that he had shot with a bow. And, you know, that in and of itself wasn't that unusual. But then I got to talking with him about it, and it turned out that he actually had a name for this deer and had known it for years. He had named it Bullwinkle. He'd been feeding it for years after he'd first noticed that. And by feeding it, I don't mean that he came to the back door, but he planted clover and he put out put out feed in areas where he was hunting. And he also had this idea that he wanted to be a hunter's guide, one of those guys who makes videos of hunting.
Mm-hmm.
You put all that together. He had been videotaping Bullwinkle also for a couple of years. Well, all of this put together, the sort of weird, or to my mind, weird sort of intimate relationship he had with this deer, his own aspirations for life, which was, I don't want to be the line cook at the steakhouse my whole life. I would like to be a hunter. I want to be a hunter who guides people and makes videos. And then what he said to me was that the greatest – I'm a hunter is what he said. And the greatest tribute I could make to that deer, to Bullwinkle, was to kill him, to shoot him. And I think that that's not an uncommon at all. I think it's a very common feeling among hunters. I don't know if you know hunters, but that's what they do.
And that's what we call paying attention. And we'll do some more of that with Duncan Murrell, my guest today on The State of Things, writer in residence at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. Our conversation continues after a short break. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Duncan Murrell, writer in residence at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. So we're talking about your career as a journalist, Mobile, Alabama, Washington, D.C., Durham, North Carolina. Then you left the Herald Sun.
Yes. I had a great time as a newspaper reporter, except for the fact that there were daily deadlines. And I just it made me anxious. I mean, at that time in Chapel Hill, you know, you were competing with two other newspapers, the Chapel Hill News and the Chapel News and Observer. You were competing with WCHL, who at the time had a reporter who was the hardest working journalist in America, in my opinion.
When was this?
This was 96, 97.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had the television stations. And I just, frankly, I hated waking up every morning wondering what I had missed. So I had at that time also been interested in writing about writers. And so I began just sort of taking on stories for myself. And one of the first ones was Lee Smith was publishing a book with Algonquin called The Christmas Letters. And I took that as a really good opportunity to go talk to a really great writer. And since her house was just up the street from the bureau in Hillsboro, walked up there and we had a really great time sitting in her – I did at least sitting in her room and talk – or in her living room and talking about writing and talking about why she did what she does. I remember she told me that she – and if she's listening, which I hope she's – not.
I kind of hope she is. She tells me she likes the show. Go
well, I remember that she told me something about that she had been a journalist also, and she was also writing fiction at the same time, and she did this interesting thing to keep them both straight, and I'm going to get mixed up what they were, but one was that she would write – I think she wrote her fiction out longhand on a pad of paper – and journalism was done on the typewriter. And that's how you kept the things apart. And I get that idea. I mean, a lot of journalists have this idea that they'd also like to be novelists. Mm-hmm. I wonder if new journalists now feel the same way. But people 20, 25, 30 years ago would have, thought, I want to be a novelist too. And trying to keep the two together and but yet separate was important. So she told me that. And I took it to heart.
Well, and I'm sure that as somebody who, if you're looking to write about writers, Lee Smith is a great person to start with because she's warm and charming and she probably made you feel very comfortable the whole time.
Oh, yeah. And several years later, I don't know that I had seen her in the intervening time. My wife and I were walking through Wellspring and this woman started calling out my name. It was her. And I thought, you know, here's famous writer person. I'm nobody. I'm a little man. And she just is a very gracious person.
So you eventually got tied up with Algonquin Books and started working for them.
Yeah. The next story was about Larry Brown, who's now left us. But he had a book coming out, and I thought that was a good time to talk to his editor, Shannon Ravenel. And during that conversation, I just moved the conversation off the story I was working on to let me ask questions that I'm really interested in. And one of the questions was, how had you become an editor? How did that happen? And we talked about that for a while. And at the end of the conversation, she asked me if I wanted to read manuscripts. And so I started doing that at night. I read manuscripts at night, and I would dump them off at the little house on Weaver Street in Carrboro and pick up another one. And I did that for a year and a half.
And reading for what?
I would read, first of all, Algonquin reads all of, and they, I'm sure that they still do this, all of the manuscripts that come in, whoever has sent them, in the order that they come in. And so they need people to read those manuscripts. And you would read it in order to write a report that would say, you know, this is what the book's about, and this is why I like it or don't like it. And I just love that.
But you were working all, you had a day job. You're still.
Oh, yeah.
And working all night.
Well, not all night, but I mean, that's what I would do. That's what I would do. It was fun for me. And when I had a day off from the newspaper job, I would go into the house and I'd get to sit and go into Algonquin Books and sit in with a manuscript. And I just felt like that world was the world I wanted to be in. It was more my pace.
And eventually you did get a job as an editor.
I did, yeah.
And what was that? What were you doing then?
Well, I was acquiring and editing books. I was mostly supposed to be working on nonfiction. I did a couple of novels, but for the most part, I acquired and edited nonfiction. And, you know, to some extent, it was not a whole lot different than being an intern reading manuscripts. On the other hand, you had to learn how to actually get in deep into a book and try to bring out of it what it's wanting to be. And that was something that Shannon taught me. And Shannon taught me a whole lot of really great things about being an editor, which sort of were also about life.
Well, you got tied up with two really great people here in Shannon Ravenel and Lee Smith, because again, you talk about what you just said, that she will teach you about life and about being gracious and about the honor and respect for everybody who mm-hmm. writes.
Yeah.
I mean, they had quite a few fairly interesting policies that not a lot of publishers hold to.
Well, she made it the policy that we would read through that whole pile in 6 weeks. Maybe it could sort of shade into 7 weeks, but if you were getting much past 7 weeks, she would go look at it and she would, you know, read us all the Riot Act. And this was when I was an editor, you know, I was an editor with a salary. I mean, I'd get read the Riot Act. That was something that she had decided, and maybe this was also Lewis Rubin, the other founder's idea also, but that after many years of working with writers, she understood that they're really sensitive people. We can sometimes be wilting flowers, and that they did not deserve to be left waiting. It's a terrible – now that I'm a writer myself, that is a terrible time for every writer, is when you have finished something and it's out there and there's silence.
Everybody got a response. Phone calls got answered. Letters got replied to.
Yeah. If we had an author that we were actually publishing and they sent a message or wrote a letter or called, if you didn't return that phone call that day, she was mad at you. But on the flip side of that, she would say that she typically did not do her editing over the phone. And she would – but that was something that I couldn't quite figure out why, and until I would be on a two-hour conversation with a writer and she would stop in my doorway and just laugh at me.
Never edit on
yeah,
the phone.
Don't do that.
What did you learn about listening? I mean, editing itself, obviously you have a love for literature. You're working your way into the business. Now you're editing. How is it different as an editor, as a professional? How do you read differently than as someone who just loves literature? Is it different?
Well, yeah, I do think so. I mean, for one thing, you have to understand the technical aspects of what makes a story work. But I don't know that that is the That's the big thing. I think the big thing and the big that was hard to figure out was deciding whether you liked something or not and why. And it was why that was the important question. And it's not something that in our typical reading we spend much time concerned with, but an editor is, because an editor wants to know what is working and how can I make it work better. Or if I'm not going to publish this book, I need to have a good reason why. So, you know, in English class, we don't often hear the professor say, "So, did you like this book, and why?"
Right.
Right.
Because it's in the canon.
We analyze it differently in college. Right. We say, you know, here are the themes in this, and here is the point of view, and here is the historical setting. Historical context of the writer's life, etc. But we don't often ask them, you know, did you like Absalom, and why?
And if not, right? Why not?
Yeah. Somebody has to answer that question, and that was interesting for me.
You edited, for instance, Robert Morgan's Gap Creek.
Yes, that was fun.
And he already had a reputation by then. This book was going to go on. Did you? How'd that go?
He was a consummate professional. He's one of the more gracious people in the world. You know, he teaches up at Cornell and teaches creative writing students, had some great ones. Lori Moore was one of his students at one time. And this is something that I found with writers, was that those who have been around a while and have done it a while, they take editing really well. And it doesn't matter if your editor is a 29-year-old who thinks that he knows everything like I was. You know, you don't get your back up about that. You listen to what they have to say, and then, you know, you should also feel free to disregard what an editor says. But something I read, and so he was really, really good about that. And maybe he understood something that I had also read in a letter that Lewis Rubin had written to one of his writers. And that was that he was saying, here's the manuscript. Here are some suggestions I've made in the margins for what to do in certain places. Now, I know that you might get offended by that, you know, me taking that kind of privilege to write on your manuscript. What he said was that I don't know how to fix it. I've just sort of suggested a way of fixing it. Only you know how to fix it. So disregard what I said, but know that there's something maybe not quite right, yeah, right there.
A skilled reader got stuck here. Pay attention to that and see what you can do with it. That's an interesting approach. You actually then had the chance to ghostwrite not a nonfiction book, but a novel. Now, that's fairly unusual. Tell us about that.
It is unusual, except that I'm not sure how unusual.
Well, yeah, exactly. How do we know, right?
Right. The community of ghostwriters don't, you know, we don't have a union or anything like that. It all happens in the shadows.
Yeah, we think about it often when it comes to biographies, especially sort of ghostwritten nonfiction.
Biographies, but, memoirs. Yeah. We may even associate it more with genre fiction. Mm-hmm. And some writers who employ, if not ghostwriters, collaborators are very open about that. In this case, it isn't very open. It was an odd situation. I had wanted to leave Algonquin, not because I was unhappy, but because I was ready to do my own work. I chose to leave in order to do someone else's work still. But it was an opportunity to sort of test out what I thought I knew about writing, about fiction especially. So I took a job in order to make ends meet. I took a job collecting golf balls and attending the range at Capital T in Raleigh. It's a golf driving range. And I would, you know, sit there at the counter doling out balls and, you know, writing a novel. It was an interesting time in my life.
The novel ended up, and I guess you can't tell us all the details because you signed an agreement, right? Mm-hmm. But the novel went on to be a bestseller.
Yeah, that was very surprising.
Did it kill you? Did it kill you?
No, it killed my mother much. It was much harder on my mother. We had to practically tie her down so she just wouldn't tell people. But no, you know, it was very cool. Yeah. For sure. And it also, the anonymity of it for me was kind of a blessing in that I got quite a lot of the experience of – I got a really great boost. Hmm. I was given quite a lot of confidence that I could – I didn't know I could write a novel. It was such a lark. I didn't
– Have you tried – I'm wondering, and I guess you haven't tried so much nonfiction since. You've done a lot of fiction – nonfiction writing, I should say, fiction since. But I wonder if that was if it was in a way liberating for you knowing that it wasn't going to come out. I mean, how that changes the way you write, although it's a hard comparison, I guess, for you to make.
Well, there was okay, so I look at it like this. I was paid to write my first couple of novels up front, and nobody gets that opportunity. And I got it. I got to see it get read and reviewed and bought by people, and to see how they responded. And yet, I don't have my name on it. I feel like I got a couple of sort of mulligans there. Do you know what I mean? That I. Not to use the golf driving range
I actually
lingo.
Didn't work at Capital T, but I think I know that's a good thing in golf, no doubt.
No, that I got a couple of free tries yeah. at it, right? And they aren't precisely the books I would write for myself. I've written my own novel and in the final stages of revising it, but I think it's pretty good. But it's not anything like those.
Well, you finally did decide to go out and write stuff under your own name. It got a big story for Harper's called The Swarm.
Yeah.
Termites. Yeah. Tell us about it.
So my father's a scientist, and he goes to scientific conventions. And, you know, one of the you have to understand that the scientific community's sense of humor is very twisted. And what they get they think is funny is, you know, not always so funny. But he thought it was awesome that he had gone to this convention and he'd brought back a paperweight that he gave me, which was this clear block of something like lucite in which was embedded – several representatives of the members of a colony of Coptotermes formosanus, the Formosan termite. And so one day.
Sorry, I thought that was a termite joke.
No. But this is the man who the first time I took my wife, my soon to be wife, to Thanksgiving at my family's in Wilson. My dad handed out – he made a big production of handing out these things that looked like apples, but they were compressed sawdust that looked red. They were red, mm-hmm. and they were laced with this fancy chemical. And they were to – you put them on an apple tree and they would attract the wrong kind of flies, and those flies would die, and then you would have no more apple borer disease. Now, this is what my dad thinks is a really awesome thing to do for yeah. your family,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And to impress my future mother-in-law. So in any case, he gave me this thing. And one of the things that you do as a writer and if you're freelancing is that you sit around trying to come up with ideas all yeah. the time. I mean, you should have 10, 12, even 15 ideas, 90% of which you'll never carry through. But you should be generating those all the time. So I was doing that one day, and I was coming up with ideas, and I'm tossing this thing in my hand because it was on my desk. It's a paperweight. And I thought to myself, termites? So there's a story no one else is writing about, which fits in my character, which is that I don't like to write about anything anyone else is writing mm-hmm. about because it makes me nervous, mm-hmm. as I've already said. and it would give me an opportunity to go down to New Orleans. So I came up with a pitch and I sent it to a friend of mine who had worked at Harper's, and he put it on the desk of Lewis Lapham. And Lewis Lapham called me up one day and he sounds like he's been smoking for 700 years. And he says, Merle, Lapham there, I love your article. How many words you want? It was like that. And I was over the moon, and that lasted for a couple of weeks, and then I had to get to work. But I went down to New Orleans, and I had a ball writing about it.
And it is a great style of journalism. I mean, that piece called The Swarm that you wrote for Harper's, you know, starts out talking about the bugs, and you get some pretty particular details of the swarm coming in and the individuals who are experienced them. And then pretty soon you're quoting Pascal on nature, and then you're quoting Borges on Pascal and reflecting yourself. And then it's back to our bugs. That kind of journalism is a lot of paying attention. There's a lot of truth involved, but also a lot of kind of subjective attention.
That's what I'm interested in. And, you know, the Borges and the Pascal and the Eugene Marais, who's also quoted in there. I mean, some people will find that really annoying. But that's just the kind of thing I like to read, and so that's the kind of thing I want to write. And nothing for me is just what it is, which probably makes me not a very good Buddhist. I'm not a Buddhist, but it would make me a very bad Buddhist. But it's not. Nothing is exactly what it is. It always has something else to it. I like to read the world like it's a big story.
We'll see what that has to do with documentary filmmaking and documentary writers when we continue our conversation with Duncan Merle, the writer in residence at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour, Duncan Merle, writer-in-residence at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. You write a piece for Harper's called The Swarm. It's a wonderful piece. And it's on the stands when Katrina hits. And, of course, Harper's thinks, well, the guy we got to get to do the piece on Katrina is Merle. Call him.
I was really reluctant. It was a month and a half after the storm that I finally got around to thinking about writing a pitch for them and agreeing to do it. I was like everyone else in America. I was completely floored by what had happened, and I thought of it as this story is way, way too big for one person. What am I going to do about such a thing? Let alone all the logistics of trying to get down there and do it. But ultimately, I felt like if the termites of New Orleans were important enough for me to write about, certainly the struggles of New Orleans are also.
But it seems like you generally feel the pressure of, if everybody's writing about it, then what else am I going to say versus how much I can tell you about a city and its people and its culture if I look at something you hadn't thought about. I mean, that seems to be your kind of perverse take on how to get at the real truth of a thing. Don't look at what everybody's looking at. Go find the other thing. And now you're being asked to do the thing that the whole nation, the whole world is focused on.
Oh, yeah. It gave me a lot of anxiety. Mm. I mean, as a journalist, I did what journalists do. I went down there and I started going to press conferences and talking with the newsmakers and so forth. And I knew ultimately that that was never going to get me anywhere, not at least doing the thing that I wanted to do. I think that the thing that sort of made sure that I didn't fall into the follow the pack mentality or just kept my what little sanity I have together was that what I was going to do that was different was that I was going to put myself in there and live there near not far from the flood zone for 8 months. And
you did that. You wrote the piece, but you say you consider it a failure. Why?
Well, that's a strong word, I guess. I mean, it fails. It fails on a lot of levels. It's successful on some levels also, but I think ultimately it fails to do what I was asked to do, which was to tell the story of this city after a terrifically awful disaster happens to it. And I'm not sure that I end up doing that in the piece. I end up discovering that possibly that is an impossible task.
I was going to say that. I mean, that's sort of the first mistake that we all do, and that's why going back to Washington, D.C., you can have 300 or 3,000 cameras and only one story because somebody thinks there's only one story. You can't. Katrina is not a story.
Look at what journalists do a lot. I mean, we go into a situation like that looking for that emblematic person, right, or couple people whose stories will stand in for the whole city's struggle. And the truth is that person doesn't exist in a situation like that. There are too many people with too many individual stories. You have to say, I'm just going to get interested in one person's story or one really sort of discrete story and let it be itself. Let it be what it is.
You're working on this story. Meanwhile, you're drinking pretty heavily this whole time.
Oh, yeah. Always.
And you're in a good place to do it, New Orleans.
Yes. Yeah, I brought that with me, my proclivities, I guess. And, yeah, New Orleans was a time – it was a dark time for everyone, and it was a dark time for me too. And in a weird way, I hope that comes across in the article, that I was sinking. And yeah, I was drinking a lot.
Sinking and yet succeeding. You're selling pieces. What made you decide to sober up?
Well, it wasn't right after that, and it was several years after that. And probably like a lot of people, when you hit bottom, what happens is that there is some stark choice that you've been given to make, and you know, you're either going to have this one thing or you're going to lose it. And I wanted the life that I had started to make for myself with my family. And I wanted to do good work. And I wasn't doing good work after a while. And, you know, addiction's a weird thing, because you think to yourself that when you're using that, you know, you're making yourself feel better.
Yeah,
or
and often,
that your life is more interesting.
Yeah, well, and often these choices don't appear to hinge on whatever the addiction is. So that having the family and having the career, none of that, you know, drinking's got nothing to do with that, right? And you didn't make that choice. At some point, you recognized that, wait a minute, this is the problem right here. It all hinges on my decision. Which do I want to, what do I want to do here?
Yeah. It's often a person needs to put that choice to you, someone who you love, and you know, you're never going to put that decision to yourself, because why would you?
Well, the answer would be pretty obvious if you ever did, and that's the problem. So who put the question to you?
My wife, yeah. Yeah, she's the strongest person I know, and I love her, and she saved my life, really. I mean, she told me there was a decision that had to be made and there was going to be consequences of it. And, you know, I sat down there on that bottom for a long time before that, man. And I was just, you know, people talk about the bottom and they said, and it sounds like it's something that you hit and then you bounce right off of. But sometimes the bottom is something that you're sitting down at the bottom of that pool and, you know, you look up and the surface, it looks really, you know, wavy and discombobulated, and it looks a really far distance away. And so you just stay down there. And she told me to get my butt up.
And you did. And you also became a Roman Catholic. Is that right?
I did. Those two things are not exactly related. But New Orleans is related to Catholicism. In that, while I was down there, I met some priests and sisters who were doing this just incredible work of trying to lighten people's load. That's the only thing I can say about that. I mean, that, you know, they weren't single-handedly building houses. They were just making things go a little bit better for people. And, you know, over time I talked with priests, you know, about the city, you know, nothing about my own faith, and just was very impressed. It's very easy in New Orleans to it's a Catholic city, and it's very easy to feel that you're immersed in an older and a Catholic culture. And so so there was that in the back of my mind. My niece was ill shortly after her birth in Albany, New York, and I was called up there to help, and while she was in the hospital. And I remember I grabbed a Catholic prayer book with me because I didn't think that I knew how to pray. And it seemed to me like the Catholics know. They've got thousands of prayers. So I had this book and I grabbed it. And at night while I was by myself in the house, because they were over at the hospital, I would sit and I would make those prayers. And one day I just said, if you will look after Alexandra, and make sure that she doesn't die, I will. This is. I was hedging even then. I will look into Catholicism, and so I did. And I called. It wasn't exactly right afterward, but a few months later, I called Sister Mary Therese at St. Andrew's Parish in Apex, and there you have it. I'm Catholic.
You did, were you raised religious?
No, I was. We were raised non-practicing Unitarians. We went to church once a year on Christmas. And I was never baptized.
And your father was military. He moved around a little bit. He was in the Navy for a while.
My father was in the Navy initially.
Yeah.
But we pretty much stayed in Rockville, Maryland the whole time my growing up.
And you ended up going into the ROTC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a teacher in high school who thought – he was the first one who told me I was any good as a writer. And then – several months later, he told me that I'd make a really good military officer. And I don't really know how those two things go together. But when you're 16 and 17, you know, a man comes and tells you, someone you respect comes and tells you these things about yourself, you'll take them on. So I pursued ROTC and the Naval Academy. And I almost went to the Naval Academy and then decided I wanted a quote unquote real college experience. My mother was very enthusiastic about all that. I was commissioned in a Marine Corps officer, second lieutenant, in May of 1990. August, Iraq rolls into Kuwait. And within weeks, my mother is down at the White House protesting the war. None of us ever thought we were going to go to war.
That's you were a protester as well while you were in the ROTC, which led to
I was. Well, I had been before.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a little bit. I'd made it my something that me and some friends did. We would go down to the South African embassy in D.C. and we would protest. There was also a punk rock element to that. The punk rock scene in D.C., which was pretty awesome, and they were my friends and heroes. They were really involved in the protests there. So I took that with me when I went to school and got involved in divestment. And one day the Marine officer instructor sees me, you know, in front of the administration building in my uniform. And it was really cool because he didn't say, don't protest anymore. He just said, don't protest in your uniform. He never said that I couldn't do that. And that was something I admire. That was before I had switched my scholarship to the Marine Corps. And it was something that I admired about him. He had a real idea of what it meant to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And one of those things was the right to protest.
You did switch to the Marines from the Navy. Why?
Because I wanted to prove how tough I was. I mean, there's just no getting around that answer. I mean, I had been a Navy scholarship student. If you're at that time when you were going into the Navy, you know, you were going to be running ships, surface ships, subs, or you were going to be flying. I was never going to fly. My eyes are terrible. I didn't really want to run equipment. I wanted to run people. Being a Marine Corps officer was a whole lot about people because our equipment isn't that – well, the kind of ground combat stuff that we did, our equipment isn't that amazing. It was really what separated one officer from another was your ability to take care of and lead people, and I wanted to do that.
So you did that, and you've talked about the fact that in the Marines, really, that your politics might have been different from the guys. You tended to be liberal. You're protesting the war and all of that, or divestment back before.
My mom was protesting the war.
She protested the war. You're back in the anti-apartheid days. But the fact is it didn't much matter, and people often knew your politics and even knew sexual orientations. People were very clear on that, and for Marines in particular, that's your experience. That's not what mattered.
No. I mean, what I found to be the case was that as long as you showed up and you did your job and you were squared away and, you know, your hair was cut right and you showed up on time, and, you know, you worked hard to be good at what you were doing and you looked out for other people and they could count on you, then a lot would be overlooked. For instance, my lefty politics. But also, I knew some gay Marines when I was in, and that was 15, 20 years ago.
And if you knew it, everybody knew it. I mean, I guess that's
the
point.
The lieutenant is not the first person to hear anything. Usually.
Right.
This one Marine was a sergeant, and he was gay, I mean, it wasn't like he was walking around telling everyone, but, you know, those things, it's a tight-knit group. People know things about people. But people respected him because he was really, really good at what he did. I mean, he was tough. He was tough. That gun crew, he worked a howitzer, six guys, they were locked and cocked. They were ready to go all the time because they were afraid of disappointing him. They did not obey his orders or whatever it was that he wanted them to do because he was gay, because they knew that he was a great Marine. So I knew that when they repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that it wasn't going to be that hard on for any of the services. But in my experience, the Marines, yeah. I just knew that they would take it on and do it.
And as you say, you know, I mean, a lot of those guys, officers, take that Constitution very, very seriously. That's the thing they're defending, and that's something we need to keep in mind.
Yeah.
As we talk about these things. But you may have been one of the few ROTC candidates who's protesting apartheid. That may be true. And then you go to journalism school, and you're the only military veteran.
Oh, yeah.
Right? In J-school.
Yeah. That was an interesting place to be. And a position to have. I think they thought I was a whole lot tougher than I actually was. I got this reputation. We were down in a bar. That's not that surprising. But we were down in a bar in Chicago. And, you know, there were some guys who were harassing some people who were with us. And I said something to them. And we sort of squared off a little bit. But I had learned in the Marine Corps that because they get in bar fights a lot in the Marines. And so I had learned that merely the confrontation with bullies is enough to diffuse everything. There's hardly ever a fight. But after that, I had this reputation of being this great fighter. I would have definitely been beaten up that night. There was a lot. This was the first time that I realized that people don't really understand very well what being a Marine or what being a military person is like if they haven't been it themselves. So
is this, let me stop you there because I got about a minute left and I want to know about what you bring and how much of this you might bring to your writing course at CDS.
Well, being engaged with others, being concerned for others is the key skill of being a Marine officer, being a military officer. And, you know, what we're trying to do at the Center for Documentary Studies in the writing program is to engage students in that act of paying attention, asking the question, you know, what is the nature of your pain? What is your life like? And listening deeply, not for the little pull quote, but for, you know, the deep answer that requires that you spend time with people over time. This was something that I first learned in the Marine Corps, that you have to be always engaged with others, that you're not going to succeed in this life without learning how to pay attention to what people are not saying about themselves and what they want to be asked about, because people really want to be asked what their lives are like. And if we can do this in writing, if we can support writers, if we can support this kind of work at CDS, I'll be very happy.
Duncan Merle, pleasure to talk with you.
Frank.
Duncan Merle, writer-in-residence for the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. For more information about the work, you can go to cds.aas.duke.edu. And that's the state of things today from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.